Well, I could hardly top that introduction. And as a description of my achievements, it's more complete than any I would have offered myself. So I have a somewhat different idea about what to do on this occasion. It's an award that I am deeply and profoundly honored to receive. And I'm put in mind of an occasion when I found myself seated in a hotel lobby, actually, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, next to Joan Robinson. And she turned to me and she said, "When they finally get around to giving me my Nobel Prize, I shall have to tell them what my contribution was." Now that she wanted to say, "I invented the distinction between a thought experiment and a hypothesis." And she gave me basically her whole Nobel lecture, which that's the only part of it, however, I remember. But what I thought I would do today is to talk a little bit in a spirit of Galbraithian humility about myself. Economics is sometimes portrayed as a contest between salt water and fresh water, between the coastal pseudo-Keynesians and the Great Lakes neo-Valrasians, between the flaws and friction model builders and the free market hardliners. As evolutionists know, both habitats are fairly sterile. Evolution occurs in the backwaters, in the mudflats, the bogs, the lagoons, the cypress swamps, and the wetlands, in the shadows of perpetually endangered habitat. In today's talk, what I'd like to do is sketch a personal journey through those backwaters. Intellectually, they are my home, as they have been, I think it's fair to say, for every recipient of the Veblen Commons Prize, with just one exception. The exception was my father, who lived and worked on the high ground, which he reached out of nowhere, or more precisely out of southern Ontario. It's roughly the same thing. And Giannini Hall at the University of California, by a unique combination of gifts, including practical knowledge of price control and strategic bombing, the principled and imaginative use of state power under emergency conditions, and surpassing grace in command of the English language. But the high ground was barren ground. John Kenneth Galbraith's influence spread around the world, but it could not take root at home in Cambridge. My father's lasting gift to me has been a solid sense that an economist is either a practical player in policy battles or nothing at all. Economics is not a theology of the human condition, nor is it a branch of pure logic, however much the attempt to make the notion into grist for undergraduates may warm academic seats. Catherine the Great had it right in 1765, when she chartered the Free Economic Society of Russia, which was suppressed in 1917 and revived in 1982, and of which, so far as I know, I'm the only American member. And Catherine the Great endowed that society, which has an office in Moscow, with the logo of a beehive and a one-word motto: useful. At Berkeley in 1969, I attended one lecture by Abba Lerner, which I'm afraid gave me a misleading impression of Professor Lerner and did not deflect me from French literature and the anti-war movement. And then I moved on, went to Harvard and played around, but took one first economics course from Vasily Leontief. And from him, I absorbed a fascination with hierarchical category schemes, industrial classifications, in other words, and matrix algebra, the basis of input-output analysis, two highly misleading guides to the field of economics, which then spent more or less 30 years in remission, sort of germinating in the back of my mind before breaking out to decorate a research agenda. I also became somewhat uselessly an expert, perhaps the leading expert, on the production of ammunition for the Vietnam War, an exercise in spatial and sectoral political economy, which did not mitigate my distaste for the underlying enterprise. In a year at Cambridge, where I arrived in the company of Professor Darity, I saw Sraffa on his bicycle, absorbed enough capital theory to be inoculated against production functions, skirted the theatrics between Hahn and Robinson, much as she inspired reverence and terror, drew close to Kaldor on the eve of his great last stand against Thatcher and monetarism, was amused by the geometric pyrotechnics of Richard Goodwin, entranced by the beautiful matching of Sraffa to Keynes in Pazzanetti's lectures, and admired Adrian Wood's quasi-Galbraithian theories of profit and wages. Adrian was my tutor, and I owe to him a deep debt. But he also sensed the barrenness of high ground, and he was gone in a year or so to the World Bank and their work on China. I did not last at Cambridge. Henry Royce, a congressman of singular wit, intelligence, and other merits, extracted me to Washington in 1975, in June, just in time for two great events. One was the invention of the conduct of monetary policy hearings, eventually rechristened the Humphrey-Hawkins hearings, which were the first formal and regular congressional oversight of the Federal Reserve. And a lesson that I learned there was the power to convene is a really important power. The power to question, the power to insist on answers, and the power to follow up to get those answers. All of these things had not existed in the relationship between the Congress and the central bank. And these hearings were basically my baby for about 5 years, come and go to get them organized. And they led to the dual mandate, full employment and price stability. Full employment and reasonable price stability, I believe was the exact language, the most Keynesian and the most successful charter of any central bank. The lines I contributed to that bill were not considered significant at the time, but they proved to be the only part of the legislation that was not a dead letter on the day it was signed. And the other big event, which happened to coincide with the start of my professional career, was the New York City financial crisis. The dawn of disaster capitalism, 3 weeks into my career as a member of the professional staff on Capitol Hill, and I was thrown into this at the age of 23 and never emerged, a lifelong ambulance chaser of debt debacles. I was sent at one point in the middle of those proceedings to brief the ex-governor of New York, Averill Harriman, on the proposal that I had written for the banking committee that insisted that there be a write-down, a haircut on the bonds as part of a resolution of the New York City problem. And I found myself confronting the governor. He was in his pajamas in a small room in the middle of the most opulent mansion in Georgetown, with a Van Gogh on one wall and a Degas in a glass case on the other side of him, and he listened to me. I thought this was kind of an intimidating place to talk about giving bondholders a haircut. He leaned forward after hearing me out and said, "I understand completely. Capital must pay as well as labor." I thought, can't ask for more than that. Of my PhD years at Yale, 1976 to 1979, not so much comes to mind. Routine drill on moribund topics, logic chopping whose flaws I had already understood my year at Cambridge. Sidney Winter generously lent a kind of protective wing without drawing me in too deeply into the quasi-evolutionary theory that he was building with Dick Nelson at the time. I, at one point, made bold to suggest that it was perhaps too much Lamarck and too little Darwin. And I did not experience retaliation for that, which I should have perhaps deserved. With help from Lucy Ferguson, for a dozen years later, my wife, I explored numerical taxonomy and applied it to budget expenditure categories in a thesis that was only ever read by one person. That was Paolo Dupin Calamone, who read it and turned up on my doorstep and became in Texas and became my first PhD student. He's now just finishing a term as Dean of Political Science at the University of Brasilia. And he also would help to launch the Inequality Project. And during that period in New Haven, otherwise, I diverted myself a week each month by going back to Washington and the Banking Committee to skirmish with the resident monetarists, both of whom were close friends, and to harass the central bankers, who were not close friends, from Arthur Burns to Paul Volcker, and eventually to the University of Maryland for a year, which was marked most by a first major paper, a comparative and institutionalist study of credit and industrial policies in France, West Germany, Great Britain, and Sweden, which was published by the Joint Economic Committee in 1991. My collaborators on that project were John Zeisman and Steve Cohen of the University of California, Berkeley, Andrew Martin, a Swedish specialist at Harvard, Richard Medley, then unknown, but later to become quite notorious in important respects, and Catherine Hill, most recently the president of Vassar. So very interesting cooperation under the auspices of the Banking Committee and the JAC. And then the revolution came. A dog's breakfast of damaging dogmas: supply-side economics, monetarism, deregulation, privatization. Each among the rising academic doctrines of the previous decade softened in ultimate effect only by an aggressive tax cut and military Keynesianism, which lay just below the surface of the Reagan administration's approach. The problem of the early Reagan revolutionaries was not that they were academically disreputable, as many claimed at the time, but that they actually were not. They were reflecting the academic trends and fashions that had become to the fore in the 1970s, and they knew it. At the Joint Economic Committee, nevertheless, we fought them all, as Royce liked to say, cooks and bakers in the front lines. My fellow members of the staff, Richard Kaufman, Mary Eccles, Debbie Matz, and others, backed by stalwarts like Bob Eisner and Walt Rostow, and also great luminaries, Tobin, Leontief, and Klein, who appeared together in 1982 at a memorable hearing Henry asked me to organize, bringing every Nobel Prize winner I could find. Well, I found those three. It wasn't bad. And the next day, the New York Times ran their picture on the front page under a luminous caption that said, "Nobel Prize winners denounce Reagan economic program." And I was standing in my outside my office looking for the article to go with the story. There was no article to go with the story. This was another stage in my political education. I was somewhat dismayed.
Pay no attention to me.
But my friends from the Republican staff, Bruce Bartlett and others, came out one by one from their offices when they saw me standing there, shook my hand, congratulated me on a great professional accomplishment. They understood that I did not, that if you have a picture in the New York Times, you don't need a story. A policy triumph followed, the collapse of monetarism, and a political triumph, 26 seats in the U.S. House in the 1982 midterms, aided by 10% unemployment. Well, admittedly, something we could have done without, except for its political effects. It was enough to stall the revolution, at least for a while. Thereafter, the economy recovered, but the damage was done. The rise of finance and technology, disinflation, globalization, debt peonage, and the decline of industry, the rise of bi-coastal inequalities, and the rusting away of the Midwest, giving rise first to Clinton and sometime later to Trump. For all of these, the course was set by Reagan and by Paul Volcker in the early 1980s. And the dogmas also morphed and lived on, shape-shifting zombies reinvented as exportable commodities in the form of the Washington Consensus, inflation targeting, and neoliberalism, each eventually squeezed dry of doctrine until only the policy shells remained. Tax cuts, central bank independence, fire sale privatizations, deficit and debt aversion, all too useful to require the foundation of thought. But I went to Texas. And I arrived there as the old institutionalists, Clarence Ayres, Wendell Gordon, Ray Marshall, were gone or fading out. Ray, of course, stayed around for a long time, but the others were gone. Yet their ethos lingered, even if few could detect it. And for me, from that point, the path forward lay in merging institutionalist mesoeconomics with Keynes's monetary production economic space-time, modeled on Einstein, a thought that was planted in my head by Robert Skidelsky at Walt Rostow's poolside. And the whole lot with Leontief's matrix sensibility. Eigenvectors and eigenvalues complete. To complement neoclassically inflected econometrics with a non-parametric paradigm, revealing the half-hidden structures in economic data. Peter Alban, this moment doing his great work on cellular automata, he caught the gist of this and kind of encouraged me to pursue it. It was all very far beyond my abilities, actually. But somehow, just the right group of students coalesced at just the right time. And they came from China, from Portugal, Mexico, later on from Spain, Belarus, Korea, did I say? India, Sudan, Colombia, Argentina, France, Poland, and Iran. And over the years, it was this group of people who formed a kind of self-sustaining group that made it possible for me to have what I didn't have before, which was a research agenda and some body of work and accomplishment along those lines. Two currents emerged from this work. One of them applied numerical taxonomy to time series vectors, organizing things according to how they behaved, notably rate of change of wages, thus reconstructing industrial and national income classification schemes to distill the underlying structural affinities revealed by co-evolution over time. Steven Weinberg took a look at this and said, oh yes, that's cladistics. Okay, I took his word for it. We combine that with the extraction of discriminant functions, eigenvectors and eigenvalues complete, which isolate and rank the dominant forces of economic change in each place and time. A referee looked at it and said, economists don't use those techniques. Now, move along, nothing to see here. Seismologists, I'd learned later, do use them. They've used them for a long time in order to distinguish earthquakes from nuclear explosions. Turns out they're quite useful. The second current was the measurement of economic inequalities. And doing this not from surveys, not from tax data, but from administrative statistics, payroll and employment records, for the most part, using a generalized entropy measure, the between groups component of Henri Theil's t-statistic. It's an institutionalist approach. It builds upon the records that are kept by institutions for their purposes, which turn out to be highly reliable and informative. And its advantages are depth, range, precision, with results that largely mirror what you may get from a very good set of household surveys, but with dense and consistent matrices of measures suitable for panel analysis using standard techniques, and from which time and space patterns emerge with very great clarity. And this allows us to show on a global scale how debt and exchange rate crises and political regime change, coup d'etat and revolutions drive inequality, mostly up, occasionally down, and how better export prices, lower interest rates, and sustained social democratic growth can bring inequalities down. This is not something which should come as a surprise to anyone who comes from this part of the world or who has any experience with it, except insofar as these basic realities are obscured by the way most economics has approached the problem of inequality over time. After an early presentation to the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia, I was approached by an elderly gentleman who introduced himself. It was John Archibald Wheeler of the Wheeler-Einstein paper in 1939, and he encouraged me this approach. And I thought, well, my circling back toward economic space-time is now pretty much complete. Einstein, of course, noted as a fundamental point that the laws of physics are the same in any inertial frame. And one would think something similar would preclude economics from having two entirely separate disciplines, macro and micro, in existence at the same time, right? Where the laws are fundamentally not the same. And I've always thought that Robert Lucas had a point, that it was a bad idea to have these two separated disciplines. Separated, of course, by the invention of Christmas Vacation, which allows undergraduates to forget one before taking the other. The only problem was that Lucas chose the wrong one. He chose to build macro, impossibly on the basis of individualistic microeconomics, when the right way to proceed is to show how microeconomics, how micro outcomes are governed by the broad movements and currents that operate at the level of the society as a whole, right? The macro foundation. Our approach to inequality shows exactly that, because inequality is, in fact, the study of distribution. It is the characteristic domain of microeconomics, but if it turns out that it can be understood most effectively as a consequence of forces that are operating at the social and spatial and geographic and level, then you have an entirely different approach, and you really have pushed the neoclassical microeconomics off the stage. I have a feeling people would like very much to have ignored our approach to inequality, but it's proving impossible to ignore it entirely. It's too easy, cheap, accurate, and replicable. And it can be done by any determined group of graduate students with a little bit of time and enough coffee. It can be applied to many problems. In a paper that will appear this year, my final doctoral student, Jehi Choi, and I have shown how in the United States, the states with the greatest increases in inequality since the 1990s have drifted toward the Democrats in presidential elections. It's required measuring inequality at the state level, including small states, in a comprehensive way on an annual basis. And then when you've got the measures, you can find this out fairly easily. Increases in inequality favor the Democrats. 14 states with the largest increases after 1992 or so all voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016. But the larger point is the relocation of distributive analysis from labor markets and micro theory to macroeconomics on a global and interdependent scale, driven by the structures of financial hegemony and power. Once again, extracting information from matrices, this empirical and descriptive work yields a merger in practice of Keynes, Minsky, Galbraith pair, and Pezzanetti, with distributive dynamics and a potential to unify economic analysis under an institutionalist, post-Keynesian, structuralist, MMT common front, buttressed by evidence and an expansive research agenda. This, my friends, I submit, is what we should do. Charles Saunders Peirce on Kepler comes to mind, that is, a gift to astronomy lay in impressing on men's minds that the thing to do was to sit down to the figures and work out what the places of Mars actually were, and not to quibble over one system of epicycles as against another. Once again, the mainstream turns a deaf ear to this day, the macroeconomics of inequality, let alone the global macroeconomics of anything, does not exist in the JEL classification codes. Now you can't have everything. A further and ongoing evolutionary development is an elaboration, which I've been working on with my friend Jing Chin, of the biophysical principles that must underpin a unified, reconstructed economics, as they do every living and every mechanical system. Only through this lens, seems to us, can economics understand scale, duration, resource costs, climate change, and above all, the essential role of regulation, which is not an intervention in a system that would otherwise exist, but an essential component to having the system in the first place, without which mammals die. They cannot regulate their temperature or their blood pressure. Machines break, companies fail, and banks and financial systems melt down. If you think about that melting down, the metaphor is already biophysical. somehow our thought and teaching and research should begin in a very serious and disciplined way to catch up. And still, and finally, at least for now, an economist must try to be useful. For an academic like a politician, this means taking your chances when they come along. In 1989, I helped to trigger a debt default in Brazil and the Brady Plan, which enabled me to make a lifelong friend out of Luis Carlos Bresser Pereira. From 1993 to 1997, I was of some use with a glorified title of Chief Technical Advisor for Macroeconomic Reform and Strengthening Institutions to the State Planning Commission of the People's Republic of China. My advice, buttressed by Bob Eisner and Jane DeRista, was largely to steer clear of Western economists and, above all, not to liberalize the capital account. They didn't liberalize it. I take full personal credit for the 25 years of subsequent economic performance in the People's Republic. Economists for Peace and Security kept me busy for a couple of decades, I think in a useful way. In 2015, I joined Yanis Varoufakis in Greece's struggle against debt peonage and neoliberal austerity, and we continue to work together on democracy in Europe, on the Green New Deal, and the Progressive International. In 2017, I had the chance to lecture in St. Petersburg, and last year also in Moscow, on the pragmatic economics of John Kenneth Galbraith. And that, in 2017, was on the centennial of the storming of the Winter Palace and the 50th anniversary of the new industrial state, point which did not go unnoticed at St. Petersburg on that particular day. And when Bernie Sanders, who does not need my advice, when Bernie Sanders becomes president next year, I'll throw in with him for what it may be worth. I have hopes for a better world, free of imperial delusions, maximally demilitarized, authentically democratic, not too unequal, working together on common problems, saving the planet for a while longer. Well, anyway, one can dream. Thank you very, very much indeed.